Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich. Today on the podcast, I'm speaking with Jessica Zucker, who is widely known on social media due to the movement she started in response to her miscarriage. She openly talks about her 16 weeks miscarriage and the more recent trauma of her journey with breast cancer. Similarly to Jessica's intent with her I Had a Miscarriage movement, this podcast is encouraging people to speak about the trauma they have endured and the grief they are dealing with. Having chosen that path herself, Jessica says,
"Yeah, because without truth and candidness around these life experiences, then what? It's almost like then the onus is on us to sort of feel what, ashamed or silenced or embarrassed or like a failure somehow, or, you know, culture wouldn't mind us feeling like that because then it would be easier if we just kind of curl up in a ball and keep it to ourselves. But I have clearly chosen not to do that."
About this week's guest, Dr. Jessica Zucker is a psychologist specializing in reproductive health and the author of I Had a Miscarriage, a Memoir, a Movement. She's the creator of the I Had a Miscarriage campaign. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, New York Magazine, and Vogue, among others. Dr. Zucker's second book is in the works. I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. And please share your comments on how you deal with miscarriage. We'd love to hear from you. So welcome, Jessica. It's so nice to have you here on the podcast. Thank you for taking your time. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I've gone through, this has been quite a year. So I've been through a lot, but I seem to be reaching, I don't want to say the other side, but another side, I guess I should say. Yeah. Right.
There's been a lot. So why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about your loss and trauma that you encountered in your life?
Okay. Well, let me go back. So as I think you know, so I'm a psychologist. I'm based in Los Angeles. I specialize in women's reproductive and maternal mental health and have done so for over a decade at this point, might be a decade and a half now. And so this is something I specialized in long before having my own sort of personal experience with, any of these related traumas. And then I was 16 weeks into my second pregnancy when I had a miscarriage while I was home by myself. Mm. So the day before I had some spotting, I went directly to my doctor's office to be sure there was a heartbeat and that everything was okay. And it was. It was that Tuesday in October. This is actually just 10 years ago. I just had the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of my loss the other day, last week. So on a Tuesday, I started spotting. Wednesday, I actually went to work because my doctor said I could if I felt up to it. And I think we can get into this later perhaps, but just, you know, we need sometimes, or we think we need in the moment, distraction from an unfolding trauma, right? Because I didn't know. I mean, everything looked fine, seemed fine with the pregnancy, and my first pregnancy was smooth and uneventful. So this was very unexpected, of course. And here I am, and 16 weeks along, and so we didn't understand what was going on. So I went to work. I was feeling up to it, and it was the following day, so Thursday, October 11th, 2012, I woke up in the morning and I was sort of roiling in pain, really, like true contraction style. But again, I didn't think that this is how things happened, right? I mean, even in the context of my work, which is spent, I would say, 85 at least percent of the time talking about pregnancy, pregnancy loss, pr- pregnancy after loss, life after loss, perinatal and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders, the whole gamut. I'd never heard a story about having a second trimester miscarriage at home alone. Yeah. So this was like the furthest thing, of course, from my mind. And my husband had taken our son to preschool and my husband went to work because it was sort of like, there was no indication that we should sort of be at the hospital or be prepared. Well, indication. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, the heartbeat was there on the Tuesday and on Wednesday night. So long story short, I was trying to get myself ready to go see the perinatologist just to get more information, if there was more information to gain or to gather. And I started to kind of have what felt like a panic attack, which I had not really had in my life. And so I was trying to sort of talk myself down. And so I went to the bathroom and got like a cold compress, you know, just to kind of find my footing. And I mean, that's when the baby fell out. I mean, I don't know. There's no other way to say it. I don't know if you want your listeners to hear this, so you can edit this out or not. But yeah, so that's how it happened.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, you mentioned you were home alone. You didn't know what was happening. And then.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is like what, again, I'd never heard about before. I mean, the baby's dangling. You're still connected to the umbilical cord. So I texted my husband, obviously, and I texted my doctor straight away and she walked me through what to do. So I had to go and get scissors and cut the umbilical cord myself. Mm. And then, you know, you basically hemorrhage because until the placenta's out, you're going to bleed. So I just had to sit on the toilet, just continuing to flush the toilet until my husband got there in order to then get me to my doctor's office. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, that day, of course, it goes without saying, is burned into my psyche in a way that is hard to put into words. But anyone who's been through trauma knows exactly what I mean. So yeah, I mean, I cut the umbilical cord and then, you know, I just like put her on a towel right near me. And my doctor had, of course, suggested that we bring the fetus to her office for testing, chromosomal testing. And I think my husband got home. I don't know. Time doesn't make any sense amidst these traumas, but he got home as quickly as possible. And then I basically needed to like put a towel down my pants because of how much bleeding. And then we got to her office and there's a lot of detail there that was pretty traumatic and intense, but eventually I was faced with the decision, I guess you could call it, between having an unmedicated DNC or waiting for anesthesia, you know, for the anesthesiologist to come to her office, which would take, she thought, maybe like an hour or something, or would I have to go to the hospital? I can't even remember those details because that didn't happen. But the fear there, though, would be the amount of blood loss in the meantime.
Yeah.
And then the possibility of a blood transfusion. And because we talked it through, I mean, the DNC was going to take up to 10, 15 minutes. We talked through like what the pain level would be. In that moment, I made the decision, like, let's just do this. So I had an unmedicated DNC, which again, I've never heard of ever in all my work. And I'm laughing because it's just so, you know, unbelievable and surreal.
Mm.
And then we drove home, not pregnant, and left the baby there to be tested. And then began the grief journey, you know.
Even now, as you're telling the story, it sounds like that, I mean, you said the words is very surreal. So listening to you and remembering my miscarriage at 10 weeks, which was obviously different, but still sort of conjures the memory up. And my assumption is that people listening to this know what you're talking about or have experienced, I don't want to say something like that, or maybe similar. And you know, when hearing your story, my guess is that a lot of people don't ever talk about their story because it's not something that people find easy to hear. And exactly. I find it important with this podcast, on one side, not to traumatize people, but on the other side, to give the floor to those real traumas in life that people have to deal with.
That's right. Yeah, because without truth and candidness around these life experiences, then what? It's almost like then the onus is on us to sort of feel what? Ashamed or silenced or embarrassed or like a failure somehow, or, you know, culture wouldn't mind us feeling like that because then it would be easier if we just kind of curl up in a ball and keep it to ourselves. But I have clearly chosen not to do that. Given, you know, the creation of the I Had a Miscarriage campaign, which I started in 2014 with my first New York Times piece. I wrote a piece detailing my loss and then sort of, you know, inviting people around the world to share their losses unabashedly. Well, either, you know, I think I said something about, you know, shout it from rooftops or even, you know, say it in hushed tones, whatever it is.
Mm.
Just my hope is that people aren't shouldering this alone or sort of harnessing insidious self-blame and guilt and shame and all the things that the research shows that a majority of women actually report feeling in the aftermath of loss.
Exactly. I mean,
it's just unbelievable and just, it's unacceptable, really. Well, and I didn't start the that campaign until after I was out of pregnancy altogether. So my doctor suggested that we wait 3 cycles after my loss if we wanted to try again. And given our ages at the time, you know, I felt like if we wanted to try again, it needed to be quickly, despite the fact that, of course, the grief was still very much alive and roaring. And so I got pregnant again sort of straight away. And being pregnant after my loss was, you know, maybe one of the most challenging periods of my life because there was really no way to trust that something wouldn't go wrong. And even though we did sort of early testing, I had a CVS, I think, at like 9 or 10 weeks. So we knew, we did receive the information there was something chromosomally off with the miscarriage. And that for us was, you know, very sad, of course, but also reassuring that it wasn't just a random loss because how, you know, my doctor figured that it probably was something like that since I had had a very smooth first pregnancy, but you never know, of course. Yeah. Until you know, if you find out. And so we were relieved to at least not live in mystery around this trauma. There was a reason for it. It made sense now. And And so in the next pregnancy, I did the chromosomal testing as early on in the pregnancy as I could, and everything was healthy. But nevertheless, you know, I mean, again, I've been sitting face to face with patients talking about stillbirth and infant loss and SIDS and, you know, all of these intense experiences. And so these stories are tucked into my body and my mind. And so even when we got the news that this pregnancy was healthy, I was, you know, recalling time and time again the various things that could still, of course, go wrong.
Yeah.
So really until my healthy daughter was born, I mean, I truly don't think I exhaled that whole pregnancy. And even when she was born, I do talk a lot about this in my book, because I think it's so important. I think we all hope that, you know, once you pass the time of your loss, that you get to relax and rejoice and glow and do all the things that we uphold as, you know, what pregnancy should look like in our culture, you know, so that we can kind of conveniently maybe pretend that these negative, these unfortunate outcomes don't really occur. And then people can say to us, well, at least you got pregnant quickly, and at least this one's healthy, and at least. So I just found that even when she was born, I wasn't as relieved as I hoped I would be.
Yeah.
You know, she did not come out crying, for example. My son came out screaming. My daughter, on the other hand, was quiet. That terrified me. So I think, again, I detail this in the book, and it's so burned into my memory that I said to the nurse, is everything okay?
Yeah.
I don't hear her, you know, and the nurse was like so beautifully reassuring, thankfully, and was just like, yep, she's just looking around, she's taking things in. And that's when I realized, like, oh, this trauma, Michael,
still living in your body. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's important for people to hear that, I mean, pregnancy after loss is in most cases anxiety inducing. And still, the trauma living in your body and in your bones, in your cellular tissue, can inform every decision that's coming on. Like, for example, I see my daughter now, she's 11 and she's the surviving twin. Her sister died at 3 days old. And I see her now.
Wow.
I see her now being quite anxious. And I'm actually not surprised. I mean, us parents, we have been traumatized and become even more fearful of anything that could happen. And as you were saying, I'm working with so many parents who've lost their children at any ages and through any reasons and through any reasons that were not even reasons or unknown factors that
yeah.
I just come to the understanding there is no control. There is no safety and security. The only promise that we're given at birth is that we're all going to die at some place. And right. So living with that paradox of having hope and trust at the same time as the reality of the traumas that we're supporting, that we're living with.
Mm. That's beautifully put. Mm. Yes, you're born, and the only thing that we know for certain is that we will die. I mean, I think that is like a mantra that needs to be almost embedded in, you know, curricula, because I think that we work so hard to deny that.
Yeah.
Because the world is so fraught, you know, and there's so much going on and there's so much fear, and it's so true. It's natural.
We're living a life, it seems, that until a certain age we're avoiding or assuming we're invincible. We're postponing our own aging and trying to constrain something to remain the same when it changes. I mean, obviously, there's this befriending of death that has happened in my life hasn't happened in the same way for my daughter. So it doesn't really help her that I have become more comfortable, because for her, it's still anxiety inducing.
Yeah.
Just even hearing about a friend of mine who was diagnosed with cancer. And then she said, oh, mommy, how did she know? And now then everything that hurts her, she's interpreting as, mommy, do I have cancer? Yeah.
Wait, how old is she?
She's 11.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm. Yeah. Well, speaking of cancer, right. Oh, I'm going to get emotional now, even though I was already emotional earlier in sharing this story. But so my book, I Had a Miscarriage, A Memoir, A Movement, came out in March 2021. And so I had been freelance writing a lot leading up to that point. And then I was asked to, if I wanted to write a book. And, you know, a book is a huge undertaking, but I felt like in a way it was a perfect sort of summation maybe of everything I had been through. It was an opportunity to put it all there. And so, you know, I gave it my soul and my all throughout, including sort of the lead up of the launch. And I had felt a lump in my right breast. I want to say, well, maybe it was in October. And my doctor felt it and she thought it was fine. But she said, you know, of course, you know, you're due for your mammogram. Everybody in COVID was trying not to get their mammograms and a million other things because we weren't vaccinated and fear of all of that. So I scheduled my mammogram for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks after the book came out. And so it was a complicated mammogram that seemed to go on for a while, which I knew was not a good sign. And it was decided that it would be wise to get a biopsy. And I'll never forget, though, that the doctor said, I'm sure it's nothing, but just to be safe. And so they wanted to schedule it for like a week or two later. I was like, well, actually, is there anything open tomorrow? Like, how would one sit with that amount of anxiety, not knowing if you could find out sooner? So 2 days later, I had the biopsy, which was actually very uncomfortable. I don't know if I was numbed properly. So physically, it was an uncomfortable experience. And my doctor, who was part of, you know, she was there for the miscarriage, obviously, my OBGYN, and then she delivered my healthy daughter with me. She was the one that called with the news. So she's a dear friend, honestly, at this point. So it's intense that she had to sort of hold that, because I guess she got the news over the weekend. And so she called me on a Monday morning to let me know the outcome of the biopsy. And so I learned that I have, it's called invasive lobular carcinoma. So the lobular part is interesting because there's two different types of breast cancer, lobular being less common and harder to identify. And so that's why, you know, we didn't know about it until now. We learned later after my surgery that it was a very, actually a sizable tumor. But the doctor reassured me that, like, you know, in lobular cases, they're always bigger than expected because, again, it's like they're considered sneaky, these tumors. I mean, so at this point, and this is kind of why, you know, even on Instagram in my community, the I Had a Miscarriage Instagram community, I didn't even have it in me, to be honest, to make my 10-year anniversary of my loss a big, you know, memorial or event. Or I didn't have it in me to write something about that, because, you know, over the last year and a half, I've now incurred this trauma that's life-threatening in a way that miscarriage, I guess when I was hemorrhaging, I felt in danger of losing my life, actually. Yeah. But this is a very, very different road. And it's a long journey. And I didn't know that. I mean, in a way, I'm grateful I didn't know, because I don't really know how I would have wrapped my head and my heart around just how elongated and treacherous this is. You know, so it's like between all the scans and all the consults and getting different opinions, and it's so consuming. And so I was diagnosed in March, in May. So I decided to have a bilateral mastectomy because I tested positive for a gene called CHEK2, which, you know, does have breast cancer risk. So we sort of, at least again, got an answer. There's not a mystery behind the breast cancer.
Yeah.
And I just felt they were going to have to surveil like the other breasts so much. I would have to get checked like every 3 months or something. It didn't feel worth keeping it. Yeah. I didn't want to have to live in, you know, talk about trauma. I mean, just the waiting and the fear. And then if it came to the other breast, then I'd have to go through this all again. So it didn't make sense to me. Interestingly, now looking back, because I've had now 4 surgeries in 16 months.
All related to the breast cancer, these ones.
Yeah. Yes, because I had the mastectomy and then for reconstruction. Oh, well, so the mastectomy was May. And then, you know, they analyze the tumor and determine through this other test as well, like, you know, if I need chemo or not, because they take lymph nodes to check that. So I did not need, I did not need chemotherapy. I wouldn't have benefited from chemotherapy. But I did do 5 weeks of daily radiation.
Yeah.
So originally when I had the mastectomy, I figured that I would get implants. I definitely gave that a lot of thought, you know, would I go flat? How do I feel about that at my age and stage in life? How do I feel about my breasts? You know, all of this very, you know, intense identity shifting, philosophical thinking. I mean, stuff we just don't picture ever having to think about. And so I thought I was going to get implants, but then there's all this research around implants after radiation having a lot of issues. So in February, I underwent a 12-hour surgery. It's called a deep flap. So it's DIEP, and it's remarkable. I mean, really, I'm just in awe that this exists and like that my surgeon knows how to do this. I mean, wow. Basically, they're moving tissue from one part of your body to another.
Yeah.
So that my breasts are actually me, a part of me already. And then you don't have these side effects that implants do. So 4 surgeries in 16 months. And oddly enough, I look back at my mastectomy. It was actually the easiest of, not easiest of all 4, but it was, I woke up relieved and okay. I think because my surgeon and I had really spoken about like, I want the same size boobs, please. Cause you know, they put in expanders, and I woke up and I looked down and I was, just, I guess, pleasantly surprised and relieved that the cancer was now hopefully out, and that I still, honestly, I felt like myself. I was not expecting that. So it's not just surgeries. It's not just radiation. It's a relationship with an oncologist for life. It's the worry that my kids might have this gene as well. It's the fact that I have to be on daily medication for at least 10 years.
Wow.
And, you know, and then there's, of course, the recurrence rates, you know. So it's just, it's befuddling. It's, yeah, it's trauma on a different level. Mm-hmm. I just don't, and, you know, my body will never be the same, which I, you know, and I have scars all over the place at this point. And so somehow a lot of that I feel comfortable with, and I still seem to, you know, like my body. I'm not angry about any of this somehow. I'm actually more, I find I have a lot of feelings about and some anger about the way that people seem to view breast cancer these days, that like, oh, no one dies from breast cancer these days. Or like, oh, well, it's out of you. You're cancer free now. Like all of these kind of like, and don't eat sugar. Sugar feeds cancer. You can't ever have a drink again. Drinking feeds cancer. Like all of these kind of like buzzy, kind of trendy or made up things that people seem to think about cancer when they really don't know much about it.
So how do you deal with being faced with all those statements and opinions and well-meant, hopefully well-meant suggestions? Because that is also a form of overwhelm that doesn't really help with being already traumatized in a physical sense.
I know. It's interesting because it's like, I feel like I created the I Had a Miscarriage campaign because of this very thing, right? This like sort of deeply ingrained misunderstanding and like insistence on silencing something so common and so profound, something that's going to endure. I mean, it's not going to go away. Miscarriage is not going to, can't be cured, right?
Exactly. And
cancer really can't be in general either. So it's like, but I don't have it in me to get on a soapbox about breast cancer. And luckily there are plenty of organizations and people who have taken on this topic. But yeah, in answer to your question, I mean, I've just noticed that I've pulled back from some people because I can't have interactions where my experience is really not acknowledged. And I don't, of course, want interactions to be only about what I've been through, because that wouldn't be helpful either. But this notion that it's behind me doesn't feel good, because I don't know that it's true.
Doesn't sit right with how you feel about it.
No, because I mean, I had a surgery like 6 weeks ago. So I'm still not able to exercise. I mean, it's just like this has basically affected every part of my life, you know.
To me, when I listen to you, it seems a bit similar to people's challenges of being with strong emotions with child loss or pregnancy and infant loss. It's like you mentioned, the at least statements, where people are, as a generalization, not everyone is like that, but let's just go with the sake of generalization for the purpose of this discussion. It's as if people are so uncomfortable with strong emotions, with challenges, with trauma, that they rather move forward and ahead. Okay, it's behind you. So move on, come back to where you were before, be the old self. Where, well, no, this is unfortunately in child loss, I'm not going to be back the person that I was before.
Ever.
And I'm only assuming that with breast cancer, that's similar, that you have been changed irrevocably.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I just even think, honestly, like the amount of recovery, the amount of times I've been through anesthesia and waking up from it and not knowing where I am and like dealing with that, you know, physical pain and the side effects from the medication and, you know, that. Yeah. I mean, look, yeah, we, we too would all like to feel like our previous selves, but the people who have been through these things, we know too well that it's not possible. And grasping for that is so unproductive and painful and not, I don't think, good for our mental health. So I think that what we must do is in some ways like an attempt to embrace who we've become and sort of try to witness this newfound self and identity. Like who am I now? Or like what, how has this affected, you know, who I think I'll become in the future? Who am I now as a mother? Who am I as a role model? Who am I professionally? So I do think traumas can have these, in some ways, like these deep, of course, and beautiful effects on the way that we live our lives. Of course, again, we wish we didn't go through it, but we don't have the choice there. So I think trying to integrate some of these, not learnings, because I don't think there's, you know, it's not like this is a lesson. I don't believe in like that this is karma and this is a lesson and that there's silver linings. I'm not into that stuff. So again, I kind of stick with more medical facts. So I have this gene, that's why this happened. And so I have to deal with it. Yeah. So we'll see. I don't know what will be.
You know, because what you said just put together the picture of, you know, what is trauma? Trauma in its essence is too much too soon, and not enough time to handle it. And it seemed to me by people wanting to rush someone ahead of where they're at, you know, you described the process at the moment where you're recalibrating where you are and who you are and your identity as a woman, as a mother, as a doctor and so forth. And it's as if we're rushing that process again by someone saying, well, at least now it's out of you. It's again, in a way, it's like I'm repeating a trauma where I'm not there yet. I'm here where I'm now. And this is individual to you, Jessica, that's where you are. And I think the message for me is to say, okay, rather than assuming or proclaiming or asking or encouraging someone to move where they are, asking, how are you now? Where are you at? How is that for you?
Right. And also this idea of it's behind you is hogwash. It's kind of like people saying, well, at least, you know, you can get pregnant. You can just get pregnant again. It's like, wait, you're not a medical doctor. And even medical doctors are sometimes stymied by fertility issues and it takes them a while to figure stuff out. And so how do we know that I don't have a cell that's running around my body that's going to appear elsewhere? I mean, so it's not fair and it's not sort of medically astute to make these assumptions or to say these kinds of things. And so I guess I end up feeling sort of minimized when people say that. You know, and yes, one could argue, well, why don't you look at sort of the, you know, if there's this, let's say a 10 to 15% sort of recurrence rate, you could look at that percentage, or you can look at the 70 something, 80 something percent that don't get it again. And depending on one's mood and one's state, you know, they may be more prone to looking at one or the other, and maybe eventually both. Maybe you can hold both, and you have to hold both. So I think when we feel met where we actually are is when we feel seen. And I think that can expedite the feeling of emotional, psychological healing and ultimate connectedness and intimacy, emotional intimacy.
Yeah.
Is when someone, like you're saying, can sit with you and say, how are you feeling? Without trying to like predict the future, project whatever, focus on something else. It's like, how are you?
Without trying to fix or fade it or make it want to go away because it's uncomfortable.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think we could talk for many more hours about all these different things, and time is never enough. But for today, thank you so much for what you've shared and your openness and your willingness to go to those raw places with where you are right now. Would it be okay to go to the rapid fire question? I think also they encapsulate some of the things that we want others to know. Would that be okay now? Oh,
yes.
So just a couple of sentences for you to find a meaningful end and your story, your truth, where you are right now. They might sound different tomorrow. Mm. So grieving and trauma means?
Evolving into a new version of yourself.
And healing means?
Healing means leaning into the depth of your experience, allowing it to wash over you, taking all the time you need, being honest with yourself about where you're at emotionally, and shoring up loads of self-compassion and tenderness.
Beautiful. What I have learned about myself in the light of loss and trauma.
I've learned a lot about my sensitivities, about even more about my own personal resilience. And you know, I've learned a lot about how driven I am as a person to kind of be part of a cultural conversation around these very difficult issues and experiences.
Hmm. One thing I wish people knew about loss and trauma.
That, as we were just talking about, you know, that these experiences are not finite, that trauma lives within our souls sometimes, and that being met with deep understanding and curiosity helps a lot.
So one specific thing that has changed since my loss and trauma that I wouldn't want to miss.
Well, like you, I feel like my miscarriage sort of gave birth to a fire in me, or woke me up to a passion about, I mean, I had already, of course, been dedicated to the topic of reproductive health, but because I now knew it firsthand, it really sort of changed my level of it was almost like I was ferociously wanting to make a dent in society, you know, even just a little bit of one, to help people question if they were blaming themselves, you know, is this maybe not your fault? You know, is this something we could think through together and shift this even just an inch or two? And then, yes, like my book coming out of this, of course, and you know, with breast cancer, I can't really say that yet. It doesn't feel like it's in the rearview mirror enough.
Yeah.
But I will say it has, I guess, enlightened me to try to be, I guess, an even more present parent. I'm just like too keenly aware of how fleeting life can be. And because I don't know how long I'll be here, not that any of us do, but you know, I can be very in my head emotionally, like about the tenderness and the, you know, the intentionality around being a mother has become, I mean, it's always been important to me, of course, but it's just like highlighted just how important it is to not take these moments for granted.
And so you definitely made a dent on many topics and on many fronts, and we're going to put all these notes in the show, all these links into the show notes. So if you're listening to this and want to find out more about Jessica, go and check in the show notes and follow the links. Well, thank you so much, Jessica, for taking your time today. Thank you so much for your sharing and your beautiful mark that you leave in this world.
Well, thank you. And just even the sound of your voice is so soothing. And I feel so grateful and honored that you wanted to include me on your podcast. So thank you for creating this.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30 minutes free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.